The Tom Woods Show, episode 1271.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, it's my job to equip you with the strongest arguments for the libertarian position on issue after issue where you tend to get cornered by your friends. Well, deregulation caused the financial crisis is still a big one 10 years later as people reflect on those terrible times. Very, very important to smash this one with a baseball bat. And I've got just the baseball bat for you. It's my free ebook, The Deregulation Boogeyman. Grab it over at regulationmyths.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, fresh from the Contra Cruise, October 21st through the 28th. I was with some of the best people on earth. We had wonderful guest speakers, just an amazing time. Everybody loved it. It was a wonderful, wonderful time. Played games, saw a lot of sights, had lots and lots of food, including, as all of us who were on board that ship will never forget, second dinner. Every night at 10:30, we went back up to the buffet, and it was a whole bunch of us. We more or less homesteaded a whole area of the ship and just had an absolute blast. So, so great. People are desperate to get back on next year. I'll be making an announcement about that very soon, but just so you can save the date, because it's sooner than usual. There is normally a year's time between these events, but next year's cruise, that is the 2019 Contra Cruise, yes, there is going to be one, will take place July 5th through the 12th of 2019. It is a summertime cruise, so that is maybe going to give you a little bit of a hint as to what the destination may be, but we'll have details coming up, and the website, which I won't give out now because it's not updated yet, but it's ContraCruise.com, but that'll be updated soon with the new information for Contra Cruise 2019. We really, really hope you can join us. It's one of these things where you have to pass the bill to find out what's in it. You have to go on the Contra Cruise to realize how much you wanted to do it. It's terrific. I mean, why would we have people coming on multiple cruises? We had people come on two. We had some people come on all three cruises who've already signed up for the fourth one. It is the libertarian event of the year, and you will have an absolute blast. It's just nonstop awesomeness. So, so great. All right. Well, while we were there, during the informal presentation that Brett Vinat gave, Brett is the host of the School Sucks podcast. He said something that made me think a little bit. Not something I hadn't heard before, but I hadn't heard it recently. And it made me wonder if maybe I should think out loud a little bit and try to solve this one. And that is, he was out on a date with a woman he was just getting to know. And it turned out, unsurprisingly, just given the numbers in America, there was an incompatibility ideologically, let's say. But Brett wanted to talk things through. You know, he doesn't want to be dismissive of people on a personal basis. He wants to talk it through. So he did that, but ultimately, finally found himself saying, because the thing is, she said to him, she asked if he was a Trump supporter, because some of the things you've said are a bit concerning, although he can't quite recall if it was concerning or if she said, some of the things you've said are curious to me. Well, either way, he was a bit on trial. So he, as gently as possible, shot back with, well, let's try to examine your situation. I mean, you've gone through K through 12 in government schools, created and run by progressives. Then you went off to college, created and run by progressives. You went off to graduate school, created and run by progressives. Then you turn around, you get all your information from the New York Times and CNN. Again, heavy progressive bias there. He said, so you've more or less just been a passive receptacle of conventional information your entire life. I mean, maybe that might be clouding the way you look at the world. So, all right, now he probably said it a little bit more, slightly more gently than that. But when you're saying something like that, it's hard to think of really of a way to say that gently, right? So the response to that coming from her was, doesn't the fact that all these smart people, like people in academia, people in, let's say, the news media, all these people think the same way, doesn't that show that they must be right if all these smart people think exactly the same way. And that's the kind of thing you hear when you complain that people like you and me are underrepresented on college faculty. So they'll say, well, we just hire the best, smartest people. And of course, those are all left liberals. And that's why these departments are overwhelmingly left liberal, because those are the smartest people. Because we all know only stupid backward people would hold your views or would hold conservative views. So I wanted to just think out loud about this a little bit today. And I'm not saying that what I'm saying here is absolutely definitive. I'm just thinking out loud about it a little bit. I do want to tell you that coming up in the very near future, I have a couple of debate episodes I'm thinking over. One would be on Elon Musk and Tesla, because I've had some pushback against Eric Peters on this subject, and I think it might be fun if we could hash that out, so that'd be interesting. Then I want to do an episode on the founding of Israel some time ago, where we had a debate on that question, but I'd like to do a more specific debate about what the proper Israeli policy ought to be toward the Palestinians, because I have a listener who has a very strong opinion on that one way, and then I'd like to bring on Gene Epstein to take on the other side, and I think that would also be a fruitful debate, because generally, the debates we've had on here, I think have been pretty productive, and that's partly because I'm doing, I think, a pretty good job of choosing guests. If we wanted to have unproductive debates, I know just the people to bring on, but I think I'm doing my best to bring on people who I know just by temperament are civil and considerate and open-minded and knowledgeable, and that's really what we want. So I'm going to try to do that, and I have a semi-celebrity sort of guest coming up, which would be fun. I have a guest with a new book on public goods theory, which to me is fascinating because this is what's thrown at us all the time. This is why the market can't produce the following 12 things, you know, because they're public goods and the market can't produce those. So we got stuff like that coming up. And I also want to have Gene Epstein on to talk to him about the debate he had at the Soho Forum on capitalism versus socialism, because he performed brilliantly and he took a tack that I would never have thought of. I would have offered a series of fairly conventional arguments, but he took a unique approach to the question that threw his socialist opponent completely off track. He was out of whack the whole debate. He didn't know how to respond, really, because he hadn't prepared for these kinds of arguments. He had prepared, frankly, for the kinds of arguments I probably would have made against him. So very interesting. So we're going to have some fun coming up. But anyway, I thought I would just turn on the microphone, talk a little bit about this subject. So is it because we're dumber that we're not more widely represented in, let's say, academia? And I think part of the answer there is, of course not. I mean, I look around at the news media and in general at what we might call our cultural elites. And I can say this to you folks because you know me well enough that I'm not trying to be arrogant here, but as simply a matter of fact, I feel like I'm looking at the most ignorant cultural elite in the history of the world. So the idea that they would think they have some kind of intellectual superiority over you and me is laughable. So what is the real situation? Well, for one thing, it is true, as some people have pointed out, that a lot of our people tend to go into business. They tend to do entrepreneurial things because we have a favorable view of the market economy. Now, I'm not saying that everybody who's an entrepreneur is a libertarian or a conservative. That's certainly and obviously untrue. But I am saying that a lot of our people, nevertheless, do tend to go into those areas because, for one thing, they believe that they are morally praiseworthy, that they're not morally so-called problematic, but that the market economy is a profoundly moral system, and it does involve service to your fellow man. It involves trading value for value, and a lot of our folks want to do that. They want to go out and create. They want to provide something. They want to be part of this market economy and not just theorize about it. So there's a lot of that that helps to account for why we're not in academia, because we're doing other things. And secondly, I think because of the environment in academia, although we'll get back to that in a minute, that also tends to repel dissidents. And if you know you're going to be despised for 30 years and shunned, or let's say treated like a weirdo or an outcast, well, that might affect your decision about whether to enter academia or not. So that's one thing. Then there's also the fact that, let's face it, it's not like academia is this impartial arena that's just impartially seeking out the best, most qualified candidates. It's not true. Now, that's not to say that a good libertarian or conservative professor might not be hired from time to time. That does happen. And of course, I'm all the time talking to college professors right here on this show. So there are some fair-minded people, it's true. But I remember when I was in academia and I was on a search committee for, I guess, was it a dean of student activities or some director of student activities, something like that. And an application came in and the guy was from Texas. And I sat there on the committee and I watched them basically throw out his application because he was from Texas. I'm not making that up. It was because he was from Texas. So, you know, we all know what that means. You know, he's probably some right-wing nut job. So we'll just throw this in the garbage. I mean, I am sure that goes on all the time. Okay. They have to conceal it one way or another so they don't get into trouble. Not that anybody's really enforcing impartiality on them, but they tend to be a little bit more subtle than that. But I've just seen case after case of obviously overqualified applicants being passed over in favor of people who are grossly underqualified. So, for instance, I'll just name an example, but there are a whole bunch. Edward Fazer is a great philosopher. And I say that as somebody who disagrees with him on a number of important things. And I think he's wrong about a number of important things. But when he's right, he's really right. And his arguments are so sound and airtight. And I think his interaction with other scholars is uncharacteristically cordial and polite and productive and sheds light on questions. And he is just enormously knowledgeable about a great many things and is qualified to write and speak in numerous subfields of philosophy. And he had a temporary position, a visiting position, at Loyola Marymount University out in California. And he was passed over for a permanent position in favor of, as I recall, a complete non-entity who, if this person had 100 lifetimes, couldn't do one-tenth of what Ed Fazer has done in his field. And to this day, a guy of his accomplishments, you look at his books and the praise they've received and the sophistication of the thought behind them and just the sheer mastery of his field that's involved, and you look at where he's teaching, it's an obvious outrage. I might say the same thing for Brian McClanahan. I mean, you listen to the Brian McClanahan show, and the Brian spelled with an O, and this guy knows more U.S. history than almost anybody you've ever heard of. And he is grossly overqualified for his current position, but he doesn't toe the line on certain questions, and that means he's doomed in a lot of academic settings. That is exactly what that means, and we all know that. We all know that. I mean, libertarians are asking me all the time, when I go to apply for academic positions, do I keep off my resume anything I've written that may indicate libertarian leanings, even if it is scholarly, even if it's something in an academic journal? And in general, I say, yeah, leave it off. Now, the fact they even have to ask me that is very significant. Do you think people say, should I leave off the article I wrote in that Marxist review? Well, why would that thought ever occur to anybody? Of course you shouldn't. I would advise somebody to put that on. Nobody's going to say, oh my goodness, a Marxist. That's terrible. This person is morally stunted and economically ignorant. Nobody's going to say that. So there's that there's just flat out, almost laughable unfairness in academia. Also, every dissident, whether in the workplace or in academia or anywhere else, knows keep your mouth shut. In a professional setting, keep your mouth shut. If you disagree with the zeitgeist, if you disagree with the progressive worldview, keep your mouth shut or there will be repercussions. Nobody who goes out blabbing and blabbing about the progressive worldview and attacking opponents of it is ever called on to apologize. I mean, maybe they're called on to apologize for some irrelevant thing they said, but nothing that's part and parcel of the progressive worldview has ever required an apology from anybody. It's always on the other side. It's the opponents of progressives who have to beat their breast in public and indicate just how sorry they are for having had an independent thought and not being quite robotic enough for our overlords. Those people have to apologize. Is this kind of environment that we all know exists? We all know this exists. If you're listening to me on your way to work, you know full well you better keep your mouth shut about certain things. You know full well you are expected to repeat platitudes robotically. You know you are supposed to be the NPC meme. You're supposed to, you know, or just shut up. Sometimes they're gracious enough to let you shut up. But even then, they look at you like, well, how can you shut up at a time like this, you know, when all right-thinking people are outraged and all that. Does this suggest an environment of impartiality among ideologies across society, including but not limited to academia? Does it really indicate a spirit of impartiality? Or does it not indicate that if you walk in there with any kind of dissent from the progressive party line, you will not be accepted? Or you'll have to work harder. I know example after example of people who are absolute geniuses, but they can't live with themselves if it means they have to toe the line. And so they won't. And so, okay, that's fine, but that means you'll never advance beyond where you are now. You're lucky we hired you in the first place. That happens. That happens. And if somebody in academia is going to try to deny that, it's just laughable. That is the way it works. Again, there are bright people who are in academia and who do very well and who are respected simply because their work is of such quality that nobody in his right mind can deny it. An example of that would be Peter Klein at Baylor. Peter has credentials, as long as his arm, beginning with his PhD from Berkeley, his academic publications in all kinds of prestigious outlets, his academic associations around the world at different universities and scholarly societies. Well, Peter Klein's going to be fine. A lot of things work together for Peter. He also has a winning personality. Everybody likes him. He's just a very friendly person, which is what you should be. But you can be, and I know this from personal experience, you can be a grump and a jerk to everybody if you're on the left. You know, they're willing to overlook a lot, you know, whereas you have to be a saint. If you're going to be a dissident, you better be a saint. And by the way, that's good life advice anyway. You should be nice. You should be generous toward people. You should be kind. And I've told this story before, but Pat Buchanan, for instance, is not exactly Mr. Popularity in the media. But when he was officially with MSNBC, nevertheless, they all knew he was a good guy because they worked with him. They all knew he was a good guy. They knew this silly caricature of Buchanan was not right. And they would all go to him for advice because he's such a good advice giver. He's just very wise. He's wrong on some things. I know that. But he's very wise. If you have a serious problem, particularly career-wise, or a strategic question you want to know about, there's really nobody better to go to. And everybody would flock to him for that reason. So you should try to be that person. But here's the real kind of stuff that I think drives a lot of this. And this is the kind of thing that I think Hayek was really getting at in some of his work. And it's that smart people, in quotation marks, tend to think that I'm really smart. And so if I could just use my smarts to plan out, let's say, this city or the economy or whatever, these large impersonal institutions, if I could mold them like clay, you know, this is the legislator that Frederick Bastiat speaks about in The Law, who looks at society as so much clay to be molded in his hands, molded into his image. I'm so smart, surely it would be better for society if I could override the nexus of individual decisions that comprise society and replace that nexus with a thought-out, rational plan. And that really was part of the driving force behind the idea of the planned economy. We can't just have people arbitrarily deciding what they're going to produce and where they're going to work and what training they're going to get. This would just be anarchy. Why, we need people in charge. And this gives rise to what I describe as the bullhorn theory of society, that for things to really happen, for there to be real greatness in society, you need somebody with a bullhorn barking out orders and making it happen. And the funny thing is, the very people who are responsible for this bullhorn theory of society, namely the progressives who think that their advanced degrees and their smarts entitle them to override your individual decisions, these are the same people who are appalled and horrified when they see right-wing authoritarian dictators shouting out commands at their societies. Look, they learned it from you. The idea that society needs a bullhorn holder in order really to function or really to reach its destiny or reach its potential. They learned it from you. They didn't learn it from us. Our whole point is that you do not need a bullhorn, is that society orders itself. That's what all our classic works spend all their time talking about. Now, separate from, yet in some ways related to this, is another idea that so-called smart people, but again, it's like, I forget who came up with the term half-educated, because that's kind of what they are. Because I wouldn't say they're stupid. It's not like they don't know what century the American War for Independence took place in. I'm sure they know all that. So they're half-educated. They may also qualify as what, I guess it's Michael Malice, I think, is channeling Vox Dei here with the term midwits. It may also be that we're dealing with midwits. We're definitely not dealing with geniuses, that's for sure. But so-called smart people also think tradition, in other words, the customary practice of millennia, is perpetually on trial. It's presumed to be irrational and stupid. And so there is no presumptive authority of the past. We can just go ahead and assume that moral norms of long standing are probably just products of ignorance and irrationality. And for that, we can substitute the pure reason of leftism. Now, there is something superficially plausible about that idea, that why should we be enthralled to the past? And indeed, there are institutions and practices of longstanding that have been outrageous injustices, that did need to be toppled, that did need to be challenged and overturned. Nobody doubts that. No reasonable person doubts that. But that's very different from just presuming that everything we inherit deserves to be on trial constantly, and that if we don't, after thinking about it for 5 minutes, we can't understand why a certain practice is what it is, we'll just chuck it because, you know, we're really smart in the year 2018. We're really, really smart. I don't know. The analogy to me is the people of all decades, the 1960s, you know, like among the aesthetic naders of civilization, that's when people decided they were going to rewrite the Catholic Mass because we're just so much more sophisticated than people who came before. And the result reads like something out of the 60s and 70s, and that's not a compliment. But anyway, look, it's 2018. We're smart. We don't need to respect what is simply handed down to us. This could simply be irrational. And as I say, it's not to say that we shouldn't critically examine the past. But the past goes back a long, long time. And there is a possibility that in addition to being wrong and cruel, a lot of things we inherit from the past might be right and might even be the result of long experience with trial and error, that societies that don't abide by certain principles don't flourish, and the ones that do, do. And the analogy I might draw would be, in your house, some of the walls are there just to serve the function of separating the rooms, and some of the walls both separate the rooms and help support the whole structure. So if I knock out one of the walls that's just there for, let's say, decorative or just purely functional purposes, the house will still be okay. But if I knock out a supporting wall, the whole thing's coming down. So if we're going to say, let's march into this brave new world where we're almost going to be obsessed with overturning everything we've inherited from the past, there's a strong possibility you're going to knock out a supporting wall. So maybe you ought to proceed more prudently. We ought to proceed with caution. Instead of having a constant thirst for novelty, maybe take a moment to contemplate the possibility that people who came before you might actually have been wiser than you. That's possible. And that's the trouble with progressives, is that the very idea of progressive implies a Whig theory of history. Tomorrow will be better than today, and the day after tomorrow will be better than tomorrow. And so the day after tomorrow, what will we have to learn from people who came before us 2 days earlier? Right? They will only wish they could have learned from us because we're always becoming more and more morally superior. Well, when you have that attitude, you're not really going to learn much from people who came before you. They will always be backward to you. And so they'll have nothing to share with you. So when they do, in fact, have wisdom, the progressives will not be in a mental state to hear it and to receive it. So then what happens to people who cling to the past, who cling to traditional ideas and practices and institutions? Well, the French Revolution gives us an interesting and illuminating example. What happened during the Reign of Terror, which occurred from during part of 1793 and into 1794? Well, what was the major feature of the French past? Of course, the Christian inheritance. So what did we have? An insane destruction of all Christian vestiges. So the word saint is going to be removed from street names. Statues of saints will be solemnly guillotined, if you can believe this. The destruction of the Christian calendar and its replacement by such a preposterous alternative that several years later, Napoleon simply scrapped it because he was smart enough to realize that nobody in his right mind had adopted this ridiculous calendar. But, of course, the Christian calendar is based on the date of Christ's birth. We can't have that because this is the New France. The New France doesn't have any of this stupid superstitious stuff. So we're not going to take the traditional, you know, lines of French provinces, what have you. Instead, we'll erase all those and we'll more or less divide France into a grid. You know, and we'll have the département that we create out of this grid because that's more rational. None of these have any meaning to anybody, but we're going to impose them because it's better to impose rationality than just to consent to traditional customary practice. So this wound up meaning violence. And it's interesting that these days we're told that right-wingers are causing violence by their words. And could you imagine if the left wing endured what the right wing endures as a matter of course every day, that their ideas were marginalized and treated and described only in caricature, that they were obviously treated unfairly to the point where they felt like they couldn't even express themselves in the workplace, and they were being purged from social media, and the traditional media was reporting these developments sympathetically, that is, sympathetically to the social media companies, the left wing would just go berserk. They wouldn't be able to handle this. It's the right wing that has to endure this all the time. It's the right wing that's on the defensive. It's the right wing that enjoys no privileges in society. And yet, apparently, the right wing is somehow inspiring hatred in other people. It's not the left wing inspiring hatred by demonizing everybody. It's not anything like that. And they're not inspiring hatred of their opponents, even though, you know, somebody shot up a congressional baseball game, I guess, last year, a Bernie Sanders supporter. They don't even see any of this, even though it's obvious. I mean, they have created an atmosphere in which tens of millions of people are made to feel like they better not say anything. And then the left amazingly somehow portrays itself as the victim in this situation. But anyway, so how did they treat their opponents in the French Revolution? Well, in the Reign of Terror, it was by murder. Most victims were political victims. They weren't even, I mean, a lot of these people weren't even opposed to the entire French Revolution. They just didn't like a particular turn that it took. And that was all that it took to make them enemies. And you will hear people say, oh, the French were just going after traitors to the revolution and traitors and people who were, let's say, colluding with other countries against France. All right, well, first of all, two-thirds of the victims belonged to the Third Estate, which was the group of people on whose behalf the entire revolution was supposedly being launched. So something's fishy about that explanation. Secondly, I'm not quite sure why nuns had to be executed. You really think nuns, what, nuns are conspiring with the crowned heads of Europe, really? What wound up happening was if you were a priest who had not taken an oath of loyalty to the regime, then you were a counter-revolutionary, and this became a capital crime. And then later in the Reign of Terror, they decided, well, you know what, forget all that. If you won't abjure the priesthood altogether, then you are guilty of a capital crime. If you're found sheltering a priest, you're guilty of a capital crime. If you own a rosary, you're guilty of a capital crime. And the kinds of ways they went about murdering people were quite gruesome. I mean, you can read about, I'll put a link in the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1271, to an earlier episode I did on this precise topic back in like the 450s episodes. but the drownings at Nantes are particularly gruesome. The case of the martyr Compiègne, this was an order of nuns. They were sentenced to death, and the reason they were sentenced to death was that they remained together as a religious community after the French government had suppressed their convent. So as you can see, obviously, if that doesn't deserve the death penalty, what does? So they were condemned. Their official crime was fanaticism. Talk about not self-aware. The French revolutionaries are going to call other people fanatics. Like, these are people who went in the cathedral at Notre Dame and had a big ceremony on behalf of the goddess of reason, and they're going to lecture other people. And meanwhile, they're slaughtering totally peaceful people, but they're going to call other people fanatics. Just is that not typical of them? Then there the shootings at Angers is an interesting example of mass shootings. These people who were the victims are known as the Martyrs of Avrier, and they were actually beatified by Pope John Paul II in 1984. Beatified is the stage that precedes canonization, that is being named a saint. So they're still in that position where they're not quite saints, but they're recommended to the church for emulation for their great virtues. So anyway, that sums up more or less how I look at the situation. So it's not a matter of they're smarter than we are, and that's why they're overrepresented. It's partly that because they are so committed to their worldview, and they really believe that all right-thinking people do and must believe as they do, that they tend to be dismissive of others and not really give them a fair chance. I've also said that our people tend to go into other fields other than academia. But also what I'm trying to say is that a little education can really be harmful for some people. A little education, which is what a lot of these people have. And so they become kind of smart, like factually smart, but this smarts leads them down paths that wind up in progressivism. So it's not that they're brilliant and that makes them progressives. I mean, there are some brilliant progressives, no doubt. But they what instead happens is they fall into this trap of thinking, because I have a great brain, then really it would be better for me to be running some government agency and ordering people around, because then people could be acting in conformity with the thoughts that I'm having in my great brain. And that would be superior to just letting them operate on their own. And this way also I can exercise my superiority over others. I think that is what's also happening, is that a lot of so-called educated people who are educated in these fields by progressives come out with a technocratic mentality that I can order society, I should order society, and I am morally entitled to order society. And so that's why you get a lot of so-called academically smart people who wind up being progressives, because they have that kind of attitude, the attitude that comes from a certain amount of intelligence. But then when you get beyond that certain amount of intelligence and you perceive really how society functions and you get how preposterous it is to think that you would want to substitute your puny intellect for the amazing workings of society on its own, when you're humble enough and you're not seeking after power, you want people to prosper, then you say, you know what, it'd be better for me to keep my stupid thoughts to myself and let society arrange itself as it has shown itself quite capable of doing. So those are my thoughts. I'll have a link or two up on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1271. And if you like and appreciate what I'm doing, I'd be very grateful if you became a supporting listener of the show. You can be proud to be a supporting listener. We have a wonderful group of people, and I have many benefits for you good folks who are kind enough to lend me some support. You can do that over at supportinglisteners.com. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.